It's episode 11, and we're nearing the end of this first series in the podcast, Pour the Tea, Will You? And today I'd love to share with you a huge slice of Australian birth royalty. I'd like to introduce to you Professor Hannah Dallin. Hannah is a professor of midwifery at the School of Nursing and Midwifery in Western Sydney University. Hannah is a leading midwifery researcher here in Australia. Her work is known, read, and referred to internationally when it comes to midwifery research. And Hannah is also a practicing midwife in Sydney. Welcome, Hannah.
Hello.
Hello, Hannah. How are you?
Good, thanks, Leslie. How are you?
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you.
You too.
So, having a baby in 2020, Hannah, it's not probably been at all what women expected to happen. Definitely not what they imagined to happen, but it's certainly true from listening and reading to the almost 200 women who completed our survey in March that it's been a time of really challenging emotions, lots of fear, lots of anxiety, and a time that our birthing families are feeling really vulnerable.
Yeah, look, I think the most important thing to begin with is the reassuring message that pregnant women are not at greater risk than the rest of the community. In fact, if you look at the community as a whole, they're at lower risk in that they are generally younger, generally healthy, and they're women. And we know that COVID-19 is something that really affects people who are older with comorbidities, and also men much more. Men are much more likely to get seriously ill with COVID-19 and die. So if you look at the stats, you know, China, 64% were men who died or got seriously ill. That was 71% in Italy, and it was twice as much in Spain. And that trend continues. So I think the first message is a reassuring one, that women aren't more affected, and pregnant women aren't more affected. And of course, a lot of that's come from our knowledge of previous pandemics, like, for example, the SARS and the H1N1 Spanish flu, where women who were pregnant were much more severely affected than the general population. So that's really important to get the good news across.
Yeah.
I think, you know, yes, it's tough. A lot of dreams have been altered. A lot of imaginings, which are a really important part of birth, have had to be reimagined or had to be sacrificed. And that's really tough. But I also think, and there's an element of grief and loss in that. There's a loss of the dreams. There's a loss of how you plan. There's a feeling of loss of control. There's, you know, what kind of world am I bringing my baby into? So there's many things that are going through women and their partners' minds at the moment. But at the same time, as in all acutely stressful situations and all kind of grief and loss situations, there's also incredible highlights and moments where I think we are gaining the wisdom. I think we're realizing what really does matter. I think we are drawing close to the people who matter most, and we're reevaluating a lot of the things in our lives. And I speak personally on this as well. Those crazy busy lives that prioritize so many external things and external goals and external realizations, we're starting to realize actually they're not the most important thing, and have we got our priorities wrong? And I kind of put that all out there because while, yes, there has been distress in pregnant women, and while, yes, there have been some unfortunate policies that have been put out that aren't in line with international and national recommendations, there's also been these threads of gold. And one of the things that's really coming out from both midwives and women is that there is more time, that there are less interruptions, there are less sort of performing for visitors, performing for other people who you may have felt obliged to have at the birth or obliged to come visit you in the early postnatal period. And because all of that kind of other noise is gone, there's a sense of, oh, okay, this is actually about me and my partner and my baby. And as a result, we're starting to see some really interesting things. For example, women holding their babies a lot more, breastfeeding going better, less weight loss occurring with infants. And at the moment, it's all anecdotal. But I think we've lost touch with some of those really important things as well, which is that when a mum gives birth and when a family is made, those first days and weeks are really critical for the family. And mm-hmm. I think we've probably taken away that need to nest and have that baby moon, which is in so many cultures around making sure that mum and baby get lots of rest and support, rather than back on your feet, back into life, you know, have hundreds of people come see you pass the baby around like a football.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that out of this, we take the good forward and we leave the bad behind us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I'm not, I don't want to dismiss or diminish that this is not incredibly tough. There's not just the pregnancy. There's not just having the babies, not knowing whether or not you can have your partner, or you know, whether you're going to be able to have your water birth or all of those things. But it's also, you know, you and your partner may have lost their job, so there may mm-hmm. be financial stresses. You may have your parents in another state or even another country, mm-hmm. so you've got that grief and loss coming from grandparents, and also you wanting to, you know, many women want to reach out to their mothers at this time. So mm-hmm. I'm not diminishing the bad, but I think there's been some good that's come out, and I hope we grasp it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've even, just like you mentioned, from personal experience, a friend of mine had her baby last week, and she said, he's so calm. He's her fourth baby, and mm-hmm. she has four boys. And she said, I don't remember the second and third baby being quite this way. You know, he seems to have a really different nature just in this first week. And I said to her, do you think it has an impact that you're not going anywhere? You don't have the stresses and the demands on you that you had before. And she hadn't put the two and two together until we had that brief discussion. And she said, you know what, it probably has a lot to do with the fact I'm home. I'm not doing all the things I did when the other babies were newborn, because she's forced into that cocoon of just bonding and skin to skin and breastfeeding whenever the baby would like to. So it's a lovely image on the one hand to imagine, but like you say, we can't discount the fact that for some people there is sadness that they can't be socially connected in the way that they might have assumed they would be.
Oh, absolutely. And little babies grow up so fast, so those moments are lost in some ways. So, you know, we have to work out ways to capture them. Luckily we're not in the time of the Spanish flu. Not only did many more people die then, but we have audio visual communication methods now. So we can Zoom and Skype and, you know, FaceTime. We've got amazing opportunities to bring each other, even if not physically together, certainly visually and in an auditory way together. We're actually about to start studying all this because we think it's very, very fascinating. So we just literally today started advertising for a study we're doing, where we want to interview pregnant women, midwives and student midwives about the experiences of, and it's called Birth in the Time of COVID. And we're also going to be doing a large national survey, so you know, I hope people look out for that. We'd love your input. And the other thing is, and I don't want to be gloomy or negative, this is unlikely to be our last pandemic, so let's learn how we can prepare ourselves better and have things better in place next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about being prepared, that's one of the things that I've hoped to achieve with this podcast, was to try and put over to women, you know, within what you can control, the real importance of preparing from a childbirth education point of view, to understand what you can do for yourself to limit the length of time that you need to be in the hospital. So I know you've done a lot of research in the last couple of years, especially with Kate Levitt and a host of other people, on comfort measures and pain management to allow women to be active and to be involved in their labour, so that they have the most natural birth that they can have. Within Lamaze, we have our healthy birth practices, which really try to advocate for that too, to get women to feel empowered and to be in control. And your research has really shown some great outcomes that comfort measures can really bring people, you know, a much more physiological experience of birth rather than a medical one.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd say, you know, there are lots of tools. We call them kind of, you know, having your tool belt to take into labour and birth with you. You can pull on different things at different times for different needs. And some things work for some people and don't work for others. Like, you know, don't even bother trying to get me to do visualization because I'm absolutely hopeless at it. I need other methods that will relax me. So everyone's very different. But I think the thing we all universally have, and this is the greatest tool in our toolbox, is our minds. Mm-hmm. And there is no doubt that the most powerful, I'll often say to my students, what's the biggest organ involved in childbirth? Now, I usually say the uterus, and I say, no, it is the brain. It is the brain, because our brain can be our worst enemy and it can be our best friend. And that is never truer than labor and birth. So, you know, I've been a midwife 30 years this year, and for 20 of those years I worked in the hospital system, and for the last 10 years out in home birth, community birth. And I realized that, you know, what I was seeing a lot of pain in hospital was actually fear generated pain. And what I see a lot less of now at home is women distressed. I see women in labor. I don't see women distressed. So the power of feeling supported, the importance of knowing that your mind is enormously powerful in how you process, reflect, respond to, and work with labor and birth are probably the greatest secret. And, you know, after 30 years of being a midwife, I can honestly say if you can get on top of that, you can pretty much capture not only what happens in birth, but afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I think that's critical. And of course, the best way to have that happen is to have somebody with you, whether that's a midwife, you know, or a doula or a support person who you feel comfortable with, who is on the same team with you, who absolutely knows what you want and you feel safe, protected, cherished, revered in that situation. Because all those things are going to allow you to do what you need to do as a laboring woman, which is to go and disappear into your body and go find that primitive brain. Go find that ancient brain, which doesn't count numbers. It doesn't think logically. It simply disappears into the senses and responds to the body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women who can tap into that ancient brain, and as a midwife, I'll often see it, because it's one great sign you're actually in labor, where they just get that glazed look and you just go, well, they're in labor land. Mm-hmm. And I see lots of women pulled out of labor land in our hospitalized systems, slamming doors, bright lights, you know, noises, strangers. These things take us away from being in that ancient brain. Mm-hmm. And so that part can't be dismissed. So by having somebody with you who is your advocate and understands all the things you want and is someone you trust, they can help to regulate that stuff. You make sure the lights are dimmed, make sure that the people don't come in the room unless that, you know, you give permission. Make sure there's not too much talking around that takes us from that, you know, ancient brain. So I guess before we even start talking about all the things that can help pain relief that are external, let's remember the heart of what really matters. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are things like, we do know water immersion is enormously beneficial. We know it reduces women's need for pain relief that's pharmacological. But it's beyond that. If you look at a woman giving birth in a bathtub compared to a bed, they're a completely different person. And one of the things that a bathtub or a pool does is it provides a barrier. There's a lovely ring around there that basically says, I'm in here, you're out there, and I have my private space, and I have some way of, you know, you not be able to get so much into my space. But it also enables women to be buoyant, to move into different positions. We observed in an ethnographic study we undertook that women do all sorts of amazing things with their legs in water, which I think are micro adjustments of the baby's head so that it comes through the pelvis better. So don't underestimate the most powerful, you know, most powerful form of pain relief that we probably have that has no side effects that we know of, which is the use of water, mm-hmm. whether that's a shower, whether that's a bathtub.
Yeah.
And then there are what we found in the study Kate led was one of the things that seemed to be the most appreciated and effective, both from the perspective of the women and the partners, which was interesting, was acupressure. So getting hold of Deborah Betts' Acupressure for Labor and Birth DVD, learning just a few of those pressure points that you practice and your partner practices, for use during labour and birth, incredibly effective strategies. And the other big thing is, you know, again, very simple stuff. Stay off the bed. There is nothing more painful than trying to labour, which is a whole body experience, and having yourself immobilised with the part of your body you want to move most in labour, which is your hips. So keep off the bed. Have lots of ability to move into positions that allow you to go forwards. We, again, in this study we undertook, we found the most physiological position in labor is forwards leaning. And you just watch women in labor when they have a contraction, they lean forwards, whether it's over the car boot or the mantelpiece. And that happens when you don't direct women to a bed. That happens the entire way through the labor. And we observed that if you don't have the bed as a central focus and you facilitate that movement, you actually find most women end up birthing in a forwards leaning position, even if it's kneeling or forwards leaning on the floor.
Yeah, it can be quite an instinctive thing, can't it? That they yes. don't even know they're doing it. It's just where they've moved to in response to how their body feels.
Yes, it is instinctive, because nature and that ancient knowledge that we've passed through the generation knows if we're forwards leaning, we're giving our baby maximum oxygen because we're taking the pressure off the big arteries at the back of our uterus, but also we are maximally opening our pelvises. And so all of that is making labor and birth happen better. So it's it is intuitive, because it's absolutely right.
The point you mentioned about the acupressure, I just wanted to comment on that just from the role of the partner. I find in the people I've spoken to, and I had a dad talk to me on a previous episode, and he mentioned the real positivity that he felt he could bring to the birth space when he had something to do. He said, as a father, it was so important to feel like you could do something. And I guess that acupressure would facilitate that the fathers have a role, they have something to do, a job to do, almost to fix something. And we know that men love to feel that needed in a space where they've got no other control.
So that's exactly what came out in the study that Kate led, that the men felt they had something they could do and it was useful, and they could touch their partner in a way that they didn't feel was hindering. So I think that's critical. I think there is nothing worse than watching someone you love in pain when you can't do anything to fix them. And men are fixers. Men, you know, when their families are threatened, and pain, sickness, you know, all of these things would be seen as a threat. The instinct in the male, and you know, not all partners are male, but the instinct is to go into protect or silverback mode, where you want to protect, where you want to comfort. So, you know, I've certainly seen several situations in my career where the husband's basically, or the partner's basically been saying, just give her a cesarean section now, give her an epidural, or just do something, because it's so utterly distressing to watch. The other thing that's important is we know more and more men are getting post-traumatic stress disorder, not just women. And one of the greatest triggers of PTSD is feelings of helplessness. So we absolutely, you know, we've done the wrong thing as health providers, or as the way we set systems up, where we say, you know, bring your partner along, and, you know, partner should be involved in birth. And then we kind of treat them like a shag on the rock, where we don't even involve them. We never speak to them. We kind of make them feel incredibly redundant. So we absolutely need to make sure that if a woman wants her partner present, there is going to be no one that's going to have greater effect over that labor and birth than that person who she wants present. And if that person is not present, or that person is distressed, she's not going to be able to labor and birth well. So if we care about the outcomes for women and babies, we absolutely need to care about what they care about. And that is most often the partner.
Absolutely. And the physiology of birth, I guess, is so important that the fathers have that knowledge as well. And I think that's something, as childbirth educators, we really encourage the men to be, or the partners to be, as engaged in learning exactly what's going to happen during birth, not from just a kind of what will happen in the room, or where do you have to park your car, or, you know, but the real physiology and the understanding, because I think that helps the partners not to feel scared, and for that fear not to, like you mentioned before, not to be passed to the labouring woman. That's the last thing she needs, is to sense that fear and to then be worried about the partner.
And also, you don't want the partner to, through their anxiety, start to get aggressive. Mm-hmm. Because once you've got the aggressive cycle set up where they study to shout or yell or act menacing, you've lost, you know, any kind of trust in that room. And no, you know, you can't give birth without trust. Trust is fundamental to bringing babies into the world. So, you know, by helping them understand the things that may happen and why we do things, but also giving them the understanding of why is it important the lights are dim? You know, why is it important we don't chatter constantly to her? You know, why is it important that you do become the silverback in the room and you do start to say to people, switch all the lights on, actually, can we have them off? We've kind of got that in our plan and we'd really like them off. And they're not going to advocate for that if they don't understand the mechanism behind why that's so beneficial. So I think we've done a really, and case studies really showed that a lot of what was effective in that study was actually getting the couples to understand how utterly amazing their bodies are and that they don't come in and hand over, that they come in and they work with the birth team and that they have absolutely every right to determine how they want that to unfold within within every possibility that there is.
I certainly know when I had my first child, I was one of those go with the flow type of first time expectant mums. You know, I had a kind of belief that the midwife would just know what to do with me rather than for me to be knowledgeable and empowered and to know what actually I wanted for myself.
Yeah, well, again, you know, coming back to Kate's study, when we did the focus group with the midwives really loved it. You know, midwives go with the flow too often in hospitals. It's survival. So they go, if a woman comes in really wanting a, you know, all natural, unmobilized, active birth, then they go with the flow on that. If a woman comes in wanting an epidural and, you know, getting on the bed and, you know, basically, how they go with that. And this is kind of how midwives will be within a system. And often the difficulty with that is that you haven't met the woman before, you don't actually know what they really want, you don't know their dreams, their hopes, their birth plan. There's a whole lot of things you don't know. So you learn to kind of almost chameleon-like move with whatever that woman is doing. So what midwives told us was when women came in, you know, saying, I really want the lights dim, I want to stay off the bed and I want to use water and, you know, we've practiced all this acupressure, there was this little part of midwives that went, oh, that's so nice, because that's actually what our job is. Our job is about facilitating normal. And they came alive. And then what happened is you had the whole birth team on the same page with the same passion. So yes, midwives are not going to force women into something they don't want, because we also know that that can cause trauma. So the work ideally is done before. If you can't have a midwife, you know, at the birth, that makes things so much easier. Then think about having a doula and a birth plan and having that communication really clear. But again, you know, I'll say it till I end up in my grave, but continuity of care is at the heart of what makes birth go right. Because birth is about relationships and birth is about trust. And if you can get that in place, then most women on earth can birth just fine. And sometimes nature needs a little helping hand. But even when nature needs a helping hand, hopefully that relationship then deals with the questions, the queries, and is able to answer some of the concerns so people are not so traumatized.
I just wanted to touch on this idea of women actually feeling that they have a voice and feeling they can engage in discussions. I kind of found it quite sad to read that women felt they couldn't say no, that they couldn't question their care.
Look, I think it's a problem in non-pandemic times too, because I think there is this complete misinformation out there that women don't have the right. And in fact, legally, ethically, in every, you know, country that has laws that deal with these issues, women have the absolute right. They are autonomous adults. They have the right to determine what happens to their body. In fact, I just wish every woman knew they are the most powerful person in that birth room. They have the more authority than anybody in that birth room. They are the final imprimatur. They are it. And if they say no, no means no. And unfortunately, our system has set up to make women think that they don't and that we are the experts. And education is very powerful in telling women, you know, that they do have a voice, though I kind of feel sad that we even have to say that. Mm-hmm. I know that in relationship-based care, it is it's so different. And we've done some filming where we filmed midwives interacting with women they know and women they don't know, even down to the point of counting the words the midwife speaks to the woman. The woman speaks many more words when she knows the midwife. Mm-hmm. Her tone of her voice is different. The way they angle their bodies to each other is different. Mm-hmm. So the relationship constructs that respect and that complete kind of trust and familiarity with what a woman wants. So a woman at any time, pandemic or not pandemic, she has absolute authority and determination over what happens to her. And one of the great, and having done loads and loads of research on women's experiences, the heart of most trauma is when things were done to women they didn't want, or their wishes were ignored, or mm-hmm. they had things done without their consent and there was not explanation. Mm-hmm. So this isn't just simply a matter of, you know, being nice to women. This is a source of mental health distress. It sends mm-hmm. women off into parenting with feelings of disempowerment, doubting themselves, mm-hmm. feeling worthless. It's you know, it's assault. It is absolutely assault. And you know, thank goodness we've now got organisation. You've got birth rights in the UK, you've got human rights in childbirth. We've got places women can now go to basically hold to account the ongoing obstetric violence that occurs, unfortunately, in almost every country in the world. Mm-hmm. But what there is no place for is to do something to a woman without her informed consent. Mm-hmm. So informed consent is about making sure you present the research, that you present the options, that you give an opportunity for her then to discuss with you what matters to her and what she does and does not want. Mm-hmm. And only then is informed consent completed. Mm-hmm. So in the case of a sweep, you would have to get informed consent. You would have to say, you know, at this point, we would recommend doing a vaginal examination where we would have a feel of your cervix to find out, is it shortening, softening? Are you looking like you're going to be going into labor soon? So we can then have discussions around induction if that's needed. Mm-hmm. One of the things I can do while I'm in there is to do a gentle sweep around the inside of your cervix. Sometimes that stimulates prostaglandins to be released and that can start to trigger off labor. But, you know, and then you've got to present the evidence of, you know, how many women do you need to do that to have one woman go into labor that doesn't need mm-hmm. to be induced. Only then have you got informed consent. Mm-hmm. I hate the word routine. I hate the word, you know, that at this point we will do this. No. There's no we will do this. There is always discussion, option and choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wondered if you wanted to comment just on what your experience has been like as a practicing midwife during this.
So I've actually not been practicing for the last few months just because I've taken on a huge role at the university. So I've actually been, you know, concentrating on being an associate dean at the university for this year. So, but I've talked to lots of midwives and we are doing this study now and listening to those midwives. Mm. And I think what I'm hearing from midwives is a deep compassion. Like mm-hmm. they hate putting that mask on because they know mm-hmm. how important the face is. Mm-hmm. I think they also are really aware this is tough for people and they can't have who they want. So I think, and I would really hope, but what I'm hearing from midwives is they're making big efforts mm-hmm. to do everything they can to mm-hmm. provide women with the very, and their partners with the very best care and mm-hmm. compassion possible. Mm-hmm. But of course, there are things that midwives have to do for the protection of themselves and the protection of women and other patients. And one of them is the PPE, the protective equipment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, wearing masks when you're particularly getting towards, you know, labor is advanced and you're getting towards the birth, putting on, you know, gowns and plastic coverings and things like that, or goggles, are things we need to do because, of course, we care for many, many women and that increases their exposure. But you can do it. Like, I've seen some lovely examples of people, particularly around intensive care and theatre, where they're writing their name on the top of their mask. Mm-hmm. You know, there's ways of, I tell you what, I think we're discovering how important our eyes are. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the Middle East. The first 15 years of my life, I lived in Yemen. And I knew very young the eyes tell everything, because the women were always veiled, and the only way you could see into their souls and feelings was through their eyes. So I think we've been using our eyes a lot. I think we've been discovering the need to communicate through touch and through the way our voices sound. And that's not a bad thing, because sometimes we're so busy, we don't do any of that well.
The fact you just mentioned about the midwife there is really just reminded me of something that someone asked me a few months ago. And women were saying, you know, I'm going to have to birth alone. I can't believe I'm going to have to birth alone. This is my worst fear. I'm going to have to birth alone. And I'd love that you just spoke there about the midwife, because these women will never be alone. You know, they would have that connection.
They'll never be alone. It's learning how to make connections in a very rapidly in really unusual circumstances. And I'll often say midwives are the best blind date you'll ever have, because they have the ability to get that communication going, that, you know, finding out what's important to you. And I've watched, you know, when we filmed midwives for a study we did, we watched what midwives who were what we called adaptive experts. So these were midwives who didn't have relationships with women. They weren't in continuity care models, but they were amazing in the way they formed connections. And we found what they did is they connected through stories. And so little things like, we would observe a midwife looking at the woman's fingernails and going, oh, I love your fingers. Where did you get them done? They're so beautiful. And by doing that, what that midwife's done is take herself from expert professional up here to, oh my gosh, she's like me. She's human. And connect and make people realize that every one of us has something in common in this world. And, you know, I think hopefully what COVID-19 has brought out is a real effort to do that, and let's hope we continue it after COVID-19 has gone away, because I think it's essential to the human experience to always maintain that connection with another human.
And I hope there's a lot of silver linings. I think in the birth world, I hope home birth is given a different kind of perspective. I think a lot of people think there's a certain type of woman would prefer or elect for a home birth. I think I want COVID-19 to actually shine a different light on that, and for generally women who've probably not even fallen pregnant yet to see it as a real option rather than a minority.
I agree with you. Interesting that women often say to other women planning home birth, oh, they say, you know, to women, other women having planning home births, they say, oh, you're so brave. And now women are all saying, you know, you've got to be brave to go into hospital. So we've had a real turnaround in 2020 with the discourse around place of birth.
I always finish the episodes with some top tips. Have you any top tips other than the great things you've highlighted so far that anyone listening can take from this as they move towards their labour, birth, or even their postpartum with their baby?
Look, you know, we've got lots of tips, but I think the biggest tip is trust yourself, trust your instinct. If it doesn't feel right, don't do it. Listen to the experts, but don't change your position on everything in order to align with it. And you know what? You've got in you the ability to do this. Believe that. And don't let people make you doubt yourself.
I really hope people listen have taken a lot from what you've said, and they feel confident, and they feel that a great birth is something they can definitely achieve.
I really hope so too, because if we can get birth right, I really do believe we can get the whole world right.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today, Hannah. It's been a real highlight for me in the series, but also as a birth educator, I follow a lot of what you do, and I'm inspired every time I read what you're up to. And so thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, and it really has been great.
Thanks, Leslie.
So that's it for another episode of Pour the Tea, Will You? I'd like to just extend my thanks once again to Professor Hannah Dallin for her wisdom, for her knowledge, for her experience that she so kindly shared with us today. If you are pregnant or have given birth during the COVID-19 pandemic in Australia, and you'd like to consider taking part in Hannah's upcoming research, please do feel free to send her an email to h.dahlen, that's D-A-H-L-E-N, at westernsydney.edu.au. And if you've listened to this episode and would like to develop your own toolkit of comfort measures to bring comfort and control with pain management during labour, please do remember the Lamaze International free online course in labour confidence. You can find that right now at elearn.lamaze.org/courses.